Okay, so hi everyone. My name is Jovana Luna Zagoritz. This is a pretty diverse crowd here in terms of language, but before I lived in the US, so I also have a phonological spelling, and I'm a postdoc in cosmology. So I'm originally from Belgrade, Serbia. I moved to the US for my last year of high school as an exchange program, and then fell into a gravitational well and stayed there for my undergraduate as well as my PhD. So I just got my PhD from Yale University in May. I was co-advised by Nikhil Padmanabhan at Yale and Richard Easter at the University of Auckland. So I sort of ran a collaboration that came pretty close to breaking causality, but we figured out like one time in the day that it works for all of us to meet. And so this is a pretty general slide. These are some of the projects that I've done in the past and that I'm still interested in. So my main thing is sort of fuzzy dark matter, or ultralight dark matter, as I sometimes call it, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in the next slides. I've also worked on primordial black holes, especially gut scale primordial black holes that would have formed immediately after inflation sort of evaporated by the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis and sort of their gravitational signatures. I've historically done some work on inflation and WIMPs, specifically WIMPzillas, which is, you know, that was an interesting project, and I'm still interested in the very super early universe, though WIMPzillas aren't all the rage anymore. And I have a side project that's very close to my heart that does basically deals with mapping Egyptian constellations onto the Greco-Roman constellations that we know today. So I'm happy to talk more about any of that. This is an overview, and now I'll tell you a little bit more about my warm and fuzzy feelings about fuzzy dark matter. So fuzzy dark matter, or ultralight dark matter, as I like to call it, so it's an axion-like scalar boson with incredibly low mass, so on the order of 10 to the minus 22 EVs, which means that it forms Bose-Einstein condensates. So originally this was sort of suggested because it solves some problems in cosmology, such as the Quark-Cusp problem, which is to say that if this is some data that I don't account for, in dwarf galaxies where sort of the input of baryons is less, less sort of extreme than in Milky Way sized galaxies, you don't see this big cusp that NFW profiles have, you see more of like a core. And these things naturally form a core because they naturally form a Bose-Einstein condensate at the center. Another way to think about this is sort of in terms of first year university physics, is you have a very small mass, which means you have a really large de Broglie wavelength of about a kiloparsec, which is about the scale of, say, a dwarf galaxy. And so you erase a lot of structure in the center and make a very specific blob called a soliton. And it also just has really cool phenomenology. The cool phenomenology and all of the other stuff comes courtesy of the equations that we use to govern sort of ultralight dark matter, which is the Schrodinger Poisson equations. So up here, we have the well-known and beloved Schrodinger equation, where psi is the wave function of the dark matter. If you square that and multiply it by the mass of the particle, you get the density of dark matter, which is like a physical observable that we're actually interested in, because the wave function isn't something that we observe. And phi is its gravitational potential, which is, of course, evolved with the Poisson equation. And so if you run a simulation like mine, it looks a little something like this. Note that everything I do is in code units because I'm a computationalist and I don't believe in units. But also, if you want to ask me what the units are, I will tell you about them. So one way to make a ultralight dark matter halo in simulations is to take two of these blobs, these Bose-Einstein condensates called solitons, or more, and to merge them together, and then you get something that looks like a halo. So note the really bright thing in the middle, that is the new core of the halo, and also note sort of the fuzziness all around, that's where this thing gets its name from. So this is sort of the interference fringes that you're used to seeing in things that are simulated with the Schrodinger equation. So it has a wealth of sort of phenomenology because you can have constructive and destructive interference. And so if I, from the moment these two things merge and we get something that looks halo-like, if I plot the profile of that thing, it's sort of a bunch of profiles at different time points are plotted in the color here, and the black is their average over time. So this is to convince you that there is sort of an up and down motion. This is called the soliton breathing mode because the core kind of expands and contracts. But in essence, the profile is relatively stable, right? Qualitatively, it stays pretty much the same. This is really great for me because I can use a small trick here by calculating the potential of that one average profile. I can exchange this phi from a time-dependent phi to a time-independent phi. That is an approximation of the potential of the halo. And I can calculate the eigenstates of this particular halo that I've chosen with my choice of phi. And so I can take my halo and decompose it into a bunch of modes and see what each of them are doing. And so this is interesting for a few reasons. I don't have all of the projects I'm doing with this up here right now, but you can sort of see that the L equals zero modes are pretty dominant at about 30%. So these are the spherically symmetric modes. And the gray down here is just the core, so just the ground state. So it's mostly the core. And down here we have L equals one through L equals four modes that are sort of less and less parts of the halo. So the halo is not a ground state of the Schrodinger equation that I've showed you here. It is a superposition of states where the ground state is just the central core. So by looking at what the core is doing individually as compared to the halo, I can sort of start to answer some questions in the literature, like for a Milky Way size fuzzy halo, how big of a core do I expect? Which has been answered many times in the literature, unfortunately with different answers. And now I will copy the person before me and just leave you on my first slide. The geese have a question. Yes.
So these cores that you have, are they always pretty spherically symmetric, or do they ever have like rotation?
Yeah, so they, well, I guess it depends how you define the core. If you define it as just the ground state, which I do, yes, it is always spherically symmetric because it is by definition the 0, 0, 0 mode, which is spherically symmetric. However, if you try to sort of fit a core profile to sort of a time averaged halo, you will probably be grabbing some of the other modes. The superposition of the other modes also makes the core do wonky things, like have the breathing mode where it kind of like stretches in and out. And sometimes it just runs around the center of mass and stuff like that, which has sort of made simulating in the past tricky because you need a lot of resolution and sometimes these things will run out of your box.
So in cold dark matter, the halo profiles are usually given by Navarro Frank White. And well, there is no clear understanding of that. What I can say, where it comes from. Have you thought if this fuzzy dark matter can somehow give another like perspective on that?
So for a profile that looks something like this, so just looking at the black one, so we basically say this is a two-part profile. So the center here is the core, that is the soliton, that is the ground state, which is pretty well defined because it is the ground state of both the Schrodinger equation and the Schrodinger Poisson full system, which is much more annoying to solve. The skirt out here does have a behavior similar to an NFW in that it goes as like r to the minus 3, r to the minus 3.5. If you decompose it and sort of into eigenstates and sort of remake it out of these eigenstates, it's pretty interesting because what you see is that the radial piece of the eigenstates, so this is my halo that I'm trying to form. So the ground state, the radial piece just looks something like this. And then the next one looks something like this. And then the next one looks something like this. And so basically this is almost a superposition of all of these bumps where the number of bumps is actually n, like the order of the eigenstate. So I sort of think of it as a superposition of the radial eigenstates, the higher radial eigenstates. So did that necessarily have to be r to the minus 3? It's not clear to me that it did, but I do think it's interesting to think of it in these terms. Does that kind of answer your question?
A question about archaeoastronomy.
Yes.
Ask a bit more with doing
there. Yeah, sure. So in my graduate school, I got actually a fellowship to work on this because my goal was to bankrupt Yale. Sadly, I failed, but they did pay for ridiculous things for me to do. And so one of these ridiculous things is that we actually have data from ancient Egypt that is tabular. So we have literally, you know, like an Excel table that is 12 by 36. Where we assume that 12 is equal to the hours of the night, because the night and day were split into 12 hours, which worked out better some parts of the year than the others. And 36 is supposed to be weeks, because the weeks in ancient Egypt had 10 days, and the last 5 days out of a year to make 365 were for partying and drinking and not for putting on tables. And so the sort of contents of these inscriptions and hieroglyphs are all asterism marked with an actual star. And so it has, you know, some sort of name in it, like he who is in the boat or something like that. And we find that these move diagonally across the table. So sometimes they're called diagonal star clocks, so it's not really clear that they were clocks. So now the great question is, partially because of the context and the provenance of these texts, is, are these actual observations of star motions? Are they based on idealized skies, or are they, you know, sort of just nonsense? I think the answer has to be that they're at the very least based on observations. They're probably idealized because they were found in tombs. So they were probably sort of maps for the dead to find their way to the afterlife. But nevertheless, except for like two constellations, one of which we're pretty sure was Sirius, and it would make sense to mark Sirius as something specific because it's the brightest star. Another one, which was Orion, unclear what part of Orion, whether the belt or sort of like the extrema. And so the idea is to, knowing what those two are, approximately try to map these onto the night sky as we see it now, and have a guess. We'll never have the truth, but have a guess at what these sort of asterisms might have been, and I don't know, make the constellations a little bit culturally richer.